It feels like we're all being told to go on this diet, take that supplement. Ozempic will give you depression, but you know what'll cure that? Weed. Or you could try to balance your hormones. At Science Versus, we're like,
what the f*** is going on?
Forget the crap online and listen to Science Versus. Just the facts. Oh, and a bunch of stupid jokes.
What is a ghost's favorite fruit? Booberries.
That's Science VS. New season out on Spotify soon.
On Sunday, October 23rd, 1864, Captain Thomas Musgrave climbed to the highest point of Auckland Island. His eyes were bloodshot with exhaustion, and he had to squint as he scanned the horizon. He willed a ship to appear.
He'd made this his near-daily ritual for the entire month of October. Musgrave and his crew had been stranded on the island since January, over 10 months, surviving off sea lion meat and what little edible vegetation they could collect. But the sea lions had migrated for the season. They were running out of food.
Thomas's Uncle Musgrave and Charles Sarpy had sworn to send help if the Grafton and her crew didn't return to Sydney by April. As the months on the island passed, the promise of rescue was the only thing keeping the men going.
Captain Musgrave knew that these things took time. His uncle had to first notify the government to organize a crew. Then it'd take even more time to make the dangerous journey from Sydney to Auckland Island. But even still, they should have arrived by now.
As he stood on the mount, looking out at the vast empty waters, Musgrave's guts rankled with even deeper despair. He had been able to ignore the truth for so long, distracted by the tasks of survival. But today, he could deny it no longer.
No one was coming for them. He would never see his family again. And without him, they would be destitute. One by one, they'd all starve to death in this horrible place. And it was his fault. It was the price they'd all pay for Musgrave's greed.
Welcome to Survival, a Parcast original. I'm your host, Irma Blanco.
And I'm Tim Johnson. Every Monday, we'll take you inside incredible true stories of life or death situations. This is our second episode on Captain Thomas Musgrave, who was shipwrecked on Auckland Island in January of 1864.
Last week, we followed Musgrave and his five-man crew as they searched for riches. After coming up empty on Campbell Island, the men tried their luck hunting fur seals on Auckland Island. However, a storm blew their ship into the rocky reef surrounding Auckland, and they were stranded.
This week, we'll track the crew's struggle to stay alive as they wait for rescue. We'll see how they creatively managed their resources and the drastic action they took to survive.
At Parcast, we're grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network.
And if you enjoyed today's episode, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review wherever you're listening. It really does help. We also now have merchandise, so head to parcast.com/merch for more information.
In November of 1863, the Grafton set sail for Campbell Island. The captain, Thomas Musgrave, had accepted the treasure hunt at the request of his uncle. Apparently, there was a fortune waiting on the island for a man brave enough to seek it. Thomas considered himself worthy of the task.
Uncle Musgrave's business partner recruited his friend, Francois Raynal, to join the mission. He had experience prospecting in the Australian outback and would know how to find the argentiferous tin that reportedly filled the island.
Englishman George Harris, 20, and Norwegian Alec McLaren, 28, served as crewmen. They also hired a cook, 23-year-old Henry Forges, whose most distinguished trait was his lack of a nose. It was reduced to a thick red scar. When questioned about the injury, he claimed that he contracted an illness at sea that ate away his flesh. Terrified that it would spread to the rest of the crew, the captain marooned him on an island.
Miraculously, Henry came across an indigenous tribe and they cured him. But then he realized that the tribesmen were cannibals. Worried that they only cured him so they could eat him, Henry fled across the island. Eventually, another ship came to dock and they rescued him.
This was only one of Henry's colorful recollections. Raynal deemed in his autobiography that they were likely all fabulous, but added that Henry was a fine cook.
All of the crewmen knew it would be a treacherous journey, that many ships didn't survive the raging storms of the Antarctic Convergence. The boundaries of the Convergence are fluid, but it's generally the area immediately above and below the 55th parallel south, leading to the nickname the Furious 50s.
The Grafton wrecked on Auckland Island during one of these storms on January 2nd, 1884. Much of the upper half of the ship remained intact, perched close to the shore on the rocky reef. Because of this, the crew was able to salvage life-saving supplies and tools. In addition, a 13-foot dinghy boat survived the crash completely intact. They were well-equipped to wait for rescue.
To escape the near-constant rain on the island, the crew immediately went to work constructing a shelter. They pulled planks of wood from the ship for flooring and used pieces of the ship's mast for supports. They put a post at each corner and lined 4 7-foot-tall poles down the middle of the rectangular structure. Once the walls were built, the center poles would support a canvas sail roof.
Musgrave planned to build cabin-style walls, stacking cut logs on top of each other horizontally, but he realized this method wouldn't work. The trees on the island didn't grow straight enough, their trunks contorted from perpetual storm winds.
Raynal had experience building huts in the outback, where the trees were similarly misshapen. He proposed they harvest more wood from the wreck to build sturdy frames, then fill them in with logs standing on end, side by side. Everything could be secured to the frame with rope.
As the cabin came together, Raynal realized they needed some kind of fireplace and chimney. The winter season would arrive in June, with temperatures dropping to 30 degrees Fahrenheit. Without a way to safely contain a fire to heat the cabin, they'd either freeze or end up accidentally burning the wood structure down.
He had previously fashioned a rock fireplace and chimney in one of his outback huts using baked clay as cement. But there was no clay on the island. In fact, most of the ground soil was mixed with peat, a naturally occurring flammable turf. It would fuel a fire, not contain it.
Raynal, still too weak to take part in the construction, sat by the fire while the other men worked and tried to come up with a solution. What else could they use to cement the rocks in place? Then, one morning, while walking on the beach, the solution struck him. Seashells.
Seashells are rich in calcium carbonate. This is also the main ingredient in limestone.
Raynal knew that the Egyptians used limestone to make lime mortar, a type of cement. It was how they built the pyramids in Giza.
Lime mortar is made from a mixture of lime, or calcium oxide, water, and an aggregate like sand or gravel. Lime is typically sourced from limestone or sometimes chalk. But it's a naturally occurring compound that comes from many sources, like seashells.
Raynal spent an entire day walking the beach, collecting shells in 2 big sacks.
With enough heat, Raynal could turn the calcium carbonate in the shells into lime. But this process, called calcining, is typically done in a kiln because it requires very high temperatures.
Raynal dug a hole in the ground and built a huge fire inside. Once it died down to the embers, he dumped several pounds of shells on top and buried it all with more dirt. He left them overnight to bake, hoping his gambit worked.
In the morning, when he uncovered the hole, the shells were transformed. He wrote in his autobiography, "This lime, mixed with the fine gravel we found under the rocks on the beach, made a capital mortar for our mason's work."
The cabin, fireplace, and chimney were completed on February 2, 1864, exactly a month after the shipwreck. Musgrave suggested they name their small settlement Epigwite, a Native American word meaning near the great waters.
They made efforts towards domesticating the homestead, building furniture, constructing shelves, and adding a window with panes of glass from the Grafton. Using canvas from the support sails, each man strung up a hammock. They used a few of the leftover planks to fashion a dining table and a long bench. Musgrave made a captain's chair from an empty cask and sat it at the head of the table.
He also made himself a small writing desk from a broken trunk. He stored all of his books, maps, and navigational tools on it. He dutifully updated his captain's log with their progress. When his ink pot ran out, he replaced it with sea lion blood, collected on their frequent hunting parties.
As the weeks went on, Musgrave and the crew grew more adept at tracking and killing their main source of food, sea lions. Even though Raynal's pistol had been recovered, they continued hunting with their clubs instead of bullets.
Except in the case of young pups. One shot from the pistol wasn't enough to kill a sea lion, even for a skilled marksman. Instead, the sound of the exploding gunpowder spooked them and sent them running.
Or worse, if the bullet hit a sea lion but didn't kill them, the enraged and injured animal was likely to charge the hunting party in response. Given the chance, an adult sea lion could easily crush or maul the men.
They encountered a particularly humongous and dominant bull several times during their hunting parties. Because of the way he lorded over his section of the beach, Raynal nicknamed him Royal Tom.
The moment the hunting party stepped onto any part of what Royal Tom considered to be his territory, he was immediately enraged. He was so influential over the harem of cows that surrounded him that the second Royal Tom sounded the alarm, the entire pack charged at the men.
The first time they met him, the men didn't flee immediately. Instead, they quickly clubbed a few of the smaller, younger seals, then ran to the safety of the dinghy boat with their prize and furiously rowed away. But to their horror, the horde of sea lions followed them into the waves, Royal Tom leading the charge.
One of the cows leaped out of the water and locked her jaws onto the side of the boat. Alec McLaren, one of the crewmen, smacked the sea lion over the head again and again, but she held firm.
Panicking, Raynal drew his pistol and fired two shots, killing her. They watched her sink down into the water, their hearts pounding. The rest of the pack, spooked, gave up their chase.
As they gained more experience hunting the sea lions, the crew grew more discerning in their targets. The first sea lion feast was revolting, the meat tough and oily. They later realized that the bull was too old to eat. His age and diet of fish added a rank taste. But younger sea lions were much more palatable. More than once, they claimed a suckling calf and considered the meat a delicacy. Musgrave compared the taste to veal.
One afternoon, in the middle of dressing a bull they'd already killed, Raynal and Musgrave heard the weak cries of baby sea lions nearby in the woods. They followed their mewling cries and discovered three pups, without their mother, under a tree.
The babies tried to flee, but Musgrave and Raynal quickly caught them. When it was time to kill them, however, the men hesitated.
In his autobiography, Raynal wrote, "They gazed at us with terrified eye, which seemed to implore our pity and ask for mercy. We were much moved and greatly tempted to spare them, yet forced by a necessity to obey reason rather than sentiment. It was not without repugnance, I may say not without remorse, that we went through the task of massacring the innocents."
In addition to sea lions, the men hunted birds, fished in the river, collected mussels, and scavenged for bird eggs. They smoked and salted the birds, as well as some large pieces of sea lion meat, to store for leaner times.
Indeed, they had plenty of food, but all the men were losing weight and showing signs of malnourishment.
Most of the time, when we talk about malnutrition, we're describing someone who isn't eating enough. But a person can be malnourished even when they're not starving. It simply means they aren't getting the right amount of nutrients from their diet, whether that's calories or vitamins and minerals.
Musgrave described their typical fare as exclusively protein: stewed or roasted seal, fried liver, fish, and mussels. We got a young seal, which we cut up and salted like bacon.
High-protein diets, like keto, instruct practitioners to eat only a small amount of carbohydrates, things like bread, grains, and potatoes. Our bodies turn carbohydrates into sugar for energy. But if there aren't enough carbs, our bodies start burning stored fats. This process is called ketosis.
It's an effective weight loss method for many people.
But they also lacked the full range of fruits, vegetables, healthy oils, vitamins, and minerals that support a healthy diet. Without these, their bodies suffered from an extremely incomplete diet. This is compounded by the physical exertion of hunting and surviving.
Musgrave described possible symptoms of this in his log. "I am getting as thin as a lantern, and some disordered fluttering and heavy beating of the heart, which causes a faintness, is troubling me."
The crewmen were also in danger of developing scurvy. In a diet devoid of vitamin C, it takes as little as 6 weeks for the symptoms to appear, and scurvy can eventually lead to death. Before the treatment of citrus fruits was discovered in 1753, it was routine for ships to lose half their crew to the disease.
Potato skins are a source of vitamin C, so Musgrave saved 20 of the potatoes recovered from the shipwreck and tried planting them in the ground, but it was a failed experiment. They rooted and then disintegrated.
The same thing happened when they planted some pumpkin seeds they'd saved and some berries they'd foraged. The peaty soil was just too inhospitable for anything to grow.
If they didn't find something to eat other than meat soon, the crew would lose all hope for survival.
Coming up, a bitter winter arrives on Auckland Island. Now back to the story.
In February of 1864, Captain Thomas Musgrave and his crew struggled to survive on Auckland Island. They'd been shipwrecked for 2 months, and while surviving, were showing signs of severe malnutrition.
Hordes of sea lions covered the beaches, seemingly enough to feed them for years, but their all-meat diet was making them sick. They had to find some kind of edible vegetable.
Henry Forges, the cook, wistfully regretted that he hadn't saved all the buckets of potato peelings he had ignorantly tossed overboard during their journey. Now they could have been the difference between life or death.
The men redoubled their efforts, scouring the island for any kind of plant that might prove edible. After weeks without luck, and their fair share of indigestion, they made a discovery on February 28, 1864.
Musgrave noted in the log, "We have found a root, which is very abundant all over the island, and it's very good food. It makes a very good substitute for bread and potatoes. There is also a great deal of sugar in it."
According to Joan Druitt's book on the Grafton, Island of the Lost, the root was a type of edible mega-herb, commonly referred to as Macquarie Island cabbage. It earned that nickname from 16th century sailors. Before the causes and cures of scurvy were discovered, the earliest whalers and seamen made it a point to stop at Macquarie Island, about 400 miles southwest of Auckland Island, to harvest a store of the plant.
They didn't know why, but when they added the plant to their stews and porridges, none of the crewmen ever contracted scurvy.
In addition, Macquarie Island cabbage is a rhizome. Some other examples of rhizomes are ginger, rhubarb, and asparagus. These types of plants have large branching root systems that spread out over large areas. Rhizomes use their vast networks to store nutrients, like starch, both to help them survive in bad weather and to feed newly sprouted shoots. This quality made the plant truly a life-saving find. Not only did it contain vitamin C, preventing scurvy, but the starchy roots provided the crew with much-needed carbohydrates.
Raynal immediately went to work, trying different methods of preparing the root, which he nicknamed saccharine root because of its sweetness. In testing, he discerned that it was certainly edible raw, but but not very pleasant.
Using the gimlet and a piece of firewood as a hammer, he punctured several good-sized holes in a piece of tin. Then he attached the honeycombed metal to some wooden handles. It functioned as a passable grater.
Raynal shredded the saccharine root and mixed it with sea lion lard to form loose patties. Then he fried it in oil, crisping up the outside. At first, the men praised the root as a godsend. But, like so many things on the island, with enough time, it lost its luster. Raynal later compared the taste of the patties to sawdust.
But he couldn't deny that the bland, mealy root had saved their lives. For now.
After only a few months on the island, the crew of the Grafton had acquired many necessities to survive. They had a sturdy shelter, a source of fresh water, and plenty of food. Now they just had to wait for Uncle Musgrave's rescue mission to arrive.
But that was still 6 months away. At the earliest, a rescue crew would reach the island in September, but October was probably more likely. It felt like an impossibly long time to all of the men.
When they first wrecked, the task of survival, collecting supplies, building the cabin, hunting for food, had occupied the crew's immediate thoughts. But now that those jobs were complete and their situation wasn't so urgent, it left their minds clear for other morbid musings.
On April 10th, 1864, Musgrave lamented in his log, "A long, stormy, dreary winter is before us, without the slightest prospect of getting away. And how those dear ones whom I left managed to battle with the misery in which my ambition and folly has plunged them, I dare not think. I am provided with a good shelter and plenty to eat, and I should then think that they shared these blessings at least. But as it is, I know not to what extremities they may be reduced."
Indeed, Captain Musgrave carried the full weight of both his family's and his crew's misfortunes. Raynal noticed how withdrawn he became as the months passed on the island. He spent more and more time alone, under the guise of hunting and keeping a lookout for passing ships.
Morale is incredibly important to survival, and it becomes harder to maintain the longer a life or death situation lasts. If faced with enough depression or despair, a survivor might stop fighting and give in to their situation.
From his experience in the outback, Raynal was familiar with the impacts of low morale. He was dedicated to keeping everyone's spirits up until rescue arrived, however he could. Thankfully, he had over a decade of experience surviving in the harsh Australian wilderness and therefore had several tricks up his sleeve.
After conjuring lime mortar from seashells and then using the putty to construct a stone fireplace, the men joked that Raynal was an alchemist or possibly a sorcerer. Over the next few months, he only bolstered that reputation.
Much to everyone's relief, he made soap from ashes and seal fat. Though in his autobiography, Raynal admitted that he created it out of dire necessity. All of their clothes were so soaked in sweat, seawater, and sea lion blood, they either had to thoroughly wash them or embrace nudity, because the fabric carried a tremendous odor.
But once they solved the smell, their clothes still had to be replaced eventually. After enough excursions trekking through the trees, they were torn to shreds. Raynal went to work sewing new clothes for everyone out of sail canvas.
When Captain Musgrave tried on his own set, he silently praised his foresight to pack extra canvas for the journey. He was vehemently opposed to the suggestion of open nakedness.
Raynal eventually figured out how to tan the sea lion hides, soaking them in barrels of lye solution for several weeks until they were pliable. Then he used the cured skins to make everyone another set of warmer clothes and moccasins.
One night, crewman Alec McLaren and George Harris jokingly challenged the magical Raynal to make some kind of alcohol. Who'd ever heard of sailors staying sober this long? It was laughed off at first, but the idea stuck with him.
A few days later, he constructed a still to ferment the saccharine root to see what it produced. With enough time, the sugary starches broke down and resulted in a weak beer.
It was a wild success with the group and a huge boost to their attitude. Feeding off this achievement, Raynal wondered if he could distill the beer into something stronger, like a saccharine root brandy.
He built another still and tested his method. It was a success, though didn't taste very remarkable. And after drinking a glass himself, Raynal realized he was introducing a dangerous element into the survival party.
The saccharine root beer was fairly weak, not really enough to get drunk off of. The brandy was another story. What would become of their survival efforts if the crew devolved into drunkenness? Morale already teetered on a razor's edge.
Raynal dumped the brandy out and told the rest of the men his experiment was a failure, turned to vinegar. No one pressed the issue, perhaps satisfied enough with the beer, and Raynal never tried again.
As the months passed, the weather turned colder. Winter arrived in earnest in early June of 1864. Several times, it snowed. By now, they'd tanned more sea lion hides, so Raynal made everyone capes from the fur.
But by the end of July, the dead of winter on Auckland Island, the sea lions suddenly migrated. Day after day, the hunting party returned empty-handed.
They had prepared for this possibility by smoking and salting several pounds of bird and seal meat. However, when they unwrapped the packages, they discovered that as the oil in the seal meat cured, it made everything taste like rancid fish.
But for a time, it was all they had. As Musgrave put it, hunger makes the most effective sauce.
As winter stretched on, the weeks passed in the same fashion. Hunt for food, eat the food, find more food. They were skilled enough sea lion hunters by now that as long as they could find a sea lion, they were nearly always successful. Of course, finding them proved more and more difficult.
On one of their expeditions, the crew encountered their old friend, Royal Tom. He was accompanied by only two large cows, abandoned by the rest of his subjects. By now, he'd been dethroned by a younger, stronger bull.
Raynal wrote, "Royal Tom recognized us, and leaving behind his two companions, he advanced to meet us, uttering, as usual, his roar of defiance. It cost us a pang to kill these poor animals, and particularly the old lion, whom we had always respected, but necessity pressed us and hunger threatened us."
The situation was made even crueler by the fact that, because of his age, Tom wouldn't even be good meat. But they were starving.
Between the occasional seal, their stores of saccharine root, and scattered jackpots of mussels and birds, the five-man crew managed to find enough food to survive the winter. By the end of August, spring was arriving, and the sea lions returned.
Musgrave estimated that if rescue came, it would arrive sometime in September or October. As the days passed and this tantalizing hope came closer to being realized, the entire group was energized.
With the return of the seals, the hunting parties went from daily to weekly. Much as before, Raynal made sure that in the wake of this inactivity, the men's thoughts were occupied with something positive.
With his encouragement, Captain Musgrave held reading lessons in the mornings, using what few volumes they had at their disposal. The Bible, a couple of English novels, and Paradise Lost.
Raynal whittled a chess set and a set of dominoes. After some experimentation, he created a deck of cards using some book pages and flower paste.
But like the saccharine root brandy, Raynal didn't consider the potential consequences of his invention. Musgrave was a terrible loser.
They didn't place any bets on the games. What was the point in a place like this? But still, Musgrave raged and sulked when beaten. Eventually, after a particularly harsh outburst, Raynal tossed the cards into the fire, destroying them.
Still, the promise of the rescue on the horizon kept their spirits buoyed. As the weeks of September passed, Musgrave felt at once hopeful and terrified. Each day that he scanned the horizon, looking for sails, the question of Uncle Musgrave's honor became more dire.
On October 23rd, 1864, Musgrave wrote in his log that he'd given up his last hope of rescue. More than himself, he despaired for his family, calling them the victims of his misfortune.
The next 2 months were another test for the group. Again, the sea lions disappeared, and this time they didn't have the carrot of rescue to motivate them.
When Christmas Day arrived on Auckland Island, it was particularly disheartening for the men. Each one of them couldn't help but long for their families, picturing the traditions they would probably never take part in again.
Raynal wrote, "My companions were lying on the ground, silent, their countenances dark with the dreariest melancholy. Evidently, they had been the victims of regrets as bitter and despair as great as mine. For a few seconds, I considered the spectacle. Then, in less time than it takes me to relate it, I felt a complete revolution working within me."
Full of vigor, Raynal addressed the men. They were not going to die on this island. To hell with Uncle Musgrave, and to hell with waiting on a phantom rescue ship. It was time to assume no one was coming. It was time they made a plan to rescue themselves.
Coming up, the crew builds a rescue boat. And now, the conclusion to our story of survival.
On December 25th, 1864, after nearly a year on Auckland Island, the crew of the Grafton realized they could no longer rely on the arrival of a rescue ship. If they were going to make it off this island, they had to build a boat.
Francois Raynal proposed that they modify the 13-foot dinghy boat, which hadn't been damaged at all in the crash, into something more seaworthy. Then the men could sail for the nearest port in New Zealand, 285 miles away.
But the other men were hesitant. Raynal wrote, "Some turned pale and were silent before the terrible prospect of venturing on a sea incessantly vexed by storms. Others objected the insurmountable difficulties of such an enterprise."
Captain Musgrave was among the dissenters. He had considered building a boat a few months before, but he ultimately rejected the idea because, to build something that could survive the trip, they needed tools that they just didn't have.
Raynal, ever the enterprising inventor, assured Musgrave that he could make all the tools and nails required. It might take some time, but what else did they have but time?
To build the necessary tools, Raynal needed a forge. This type of hearth uses controlled airflow to raise the temperature of a fire until it's high enough to melt and temper metal. There are a few different ways to raise the temperature, but one of the most common is with bellows. With this handheld pump, the smith shoots a continuous stream of air in strategic locations, feeding the flames with oxygen until they reach the correct temperature.
In perhaps his most impressive stroke of sorcery, Raynal fashioned a pair of accordion bellows from wood and sea lion skin. It was arguably the most challenging part of the forge to build, and he tackled it in just over a week.
When he showed the bellows to the rest of the crewmen, Raynal watched the hope return to their eyes. He'd earned their trust with this piece of craftsmanship. This wasn't another false promise.
They decided to divide their labor. George Harris and Henry Forges took over all of the hunting, cooking, and household duties. Alec McLaren produced as much charcoal for the forge as possible. Raynal and Musgrave built the boat.
Though, from Raynal's account, their contributions may not have been equal. He recalled a day when he particularly struggled to manipulate a piece of metal in the forge, scorching his hand again and again. Musgrave stood silent, observing his ordeal, never offering to take a turn in front of the hot oven.
But then, when Raynal was finally successful, Musgrave cheered, "Bravo! Victory is ours! look at the master blacksmith, the most accomplished in his trade. To work, let us beat the iron while it's hot.
In another instance, Musgrave became hysterical in the middle of punching holes in the sail. The color drained from his face as he held up the gimlet to Raynal. The sharp tip of the tool had snapped off. How would they finish the sail riggings? Musgrave cried out, "All is lost!"
Raynal couldn't contain his laughter. While Musgrave blustered, Raynal quickly used the grindstone to sharpen the gimlet until it was good as new.
After nearly 7 months of work, their renovations were complete. They christened the new boat Rescue. On June 27, 1865, they launched it into the bay to test their craftsmanship. But on her maiden voyage, she nearly capsized. Even with the added 4 feet in length and extra ballast weights, the dinghy couldn't accommodate 5 men.
They were suddenly faced with yet another unintended consequence of Raynal's ingenuity. For the rescue mission to succeed, someone had to stay behind.
It was a terrifying prospect. There was no guarantee the boat would survive on the open ocean. And even if it did, could the men left on the island survive long enough for them to come back?
But if no one went for help, they'd all likely die here. The men argued over who should stay and who should go.
On July 13th, Captain Musgrave made an executive decision. He, Francois Raynal, and Alec McLaren would attempt to sail to New Zealand, and George Harris and Henry Forges would stay behind. Assuming they reached a port, they would immediately assemble a rescue crew to come back for George and Henry.
The young crewman struggled with his decision at first. Musgrave wrote, "They were afraid to go, yet they objected to being left behind."
But in the end, George and Henry decided that they were actually glad to stay behind and not have to sail such rough seas in a nutshell.
Still, they couldn't leave yet. Musgrave could tell from the barometer level that another storm was on the way. They would wait for it to pass and then set sail.
In the meantime, they hunted as much as possible to stock George and Henry with plenty of food to survive on their own. Raynal also agreed to leave the men his pistol and remaining gunpowder.
July 19, 1865, dawned sunny and clear. It was time to sail. The men sat together for breakfast at the dining table in Epigwhite and prayed.
George Harris and Henry Forges accompanied the three travelers down to the beach to help them launch the rescue. The men said their goodbyes, letting their emotions show. The last year and a half had bound them together in unimaginable ways. Raynal admitted that he shed a few tears before boarding the boat.
George and Henry waved from the shore for a few moments until the rescue was out of sight. Then they headed back to Epigwhite to wait.
Captain Musgrave manned the tiller, carefully watching the compass. So many lives would be determined by the success or failure of the next 285 miles.
They passed one of their first crucial tests around 3 p.m. that day, navigating through a minefield of coral reefs that jutted out just past the most northern tip of Auckland Island. After crossing the rocks without incident, they continued north toward New Zealand.
Musgrave estimated they were sailing at a pace of 6 knots an hour. It would take between 50 and 60 hours to reach the nearest port, depending on the wind.
The Rescue was proving herself seaworthy, but also taking on a fair amount of water from the waves that broke over the sides. One of the men had to stand by the pump and continuously bail her out.
And then, just as the sun started to set, Musgrave saw massive clouds gathering on the horizon. They were going to have to sail directly through a hurricane.
Raynal described how the gigantic waves violently tossed the small boat, writing, "They raised us up upon their huge backs to sink under us immediately and plunge us into the depths of their shifting abysses. Our course contained to be a series of ascents and descents, of upheavals and depressions, until we were almost dizzy."
The hurricane continued through the night. At one point, the rain froze to hail and snow. The men huddled under the sides of the boat, unable to do anything else.
In the morning, it continued to rain, but the sea was somewhat less agitated. Hoping to relieve their lingering seasickness, Raynal retrieved a package of roasted sea lion meat.
But it had gone rancid somehow. The smell was so horrific, they tossed it overboard, and Musgrave lost his appetite for the rest of the trip.
That night, the ferocious weather resumed its barrage of wind and rain. The rescue was battered by wave after wave. At one point, a wall of water broke on the deck of the boat and threatened to capsize it. The three men screamed in horror, but eventually, the ship righted.
The storm continued throughout the third and fourth day of their journey. Musgrave, Raynal, and Alec were so seasick from the rough water, they couldn't keep any food or water down.
The three men lay on the bottom of the boat, frozen from the icy rain, delirious from hunger, trying to ride out the weather.
Finally, on the fifth day, July 23rd, the rain stopped. Even better, the men could see a landmass up ahead. It gave them the boost they needed, and they mustered the last bit of their strength to hoist the sail.
Then, with the port in sight up ahead, the wind died and their sails went limp. It was maddening for Raynal. He wrote, "It is true that we had our oars, but we had no longer the strength to make use of them. We saw ourselves on the point of drifting out to sea and perishing in sight of port."
He thought about how many days on Auckland he'd been able to survive, how much work he'd done to keep the men alive, the struggle to build the rescue. And now, at the final hurdle, he had nothing left to give.
Fortunately, later that night, the wind picked back up. Nearly 20 months after wrecking on Auckland Island, they reached New Zealand at 11 a.m. the next morning, on July 24th, 1865.
The men sailed their boat along the deserted shore, desperately searching for any sign of civilization. Eventually, they came across a collection of Maori huts. A white man and his Newfoundland dog played fetch outside.
When he saw the three haggard crewmen, the man immediately rushed over to help them pull their boat out of the water. The dog's barking drew more people out of the huts. They all swarmed around. In the excitement, Alec passed out. A few of the residents scooped him up and they all went inside one of the huts.
The men were each given a bath and a fresh set of clothes. Once they'd cleaned up, the man from the beach sat down with them for dinner. His name, they learned, was Mr. Cross, captain of the Flying Scud. He was married to a Maori woman and lived here with her family, but was originally from England.
His wife prepared a feast for the weary travelers: pork cutlets, fish, potatoes, and steaming loaves of bread. Between bites, they told Mr. Cross about the shipwreck of the Grafton and how they managed to survive the last 18 months.
But before they could finish the story, all three of them were suddenly overcome with exhaustion. Mrs. Cross showed them each to a bed to lay down. They slept for 24 hours straight.
When Raynal woke up, he realized that the floor was shifting under him. He was on a boat again. He scrambled to the deck to find the captain.
The captain, in fact, was Mr. Cross. They were on the Flying Scud, heading for Invercargill. It was a bigger city with a larger port about 50 miles away. They would have an easier time finding a crew there to retrieve George and Henry from Auckland Island.
When they arrived on July 27th, the details of their harrowing journey quickly spread throughout Invercargill. The newspaper even published an article on them.
Musgrave pleaded to the local government for money to hire a rescue ship, but because none of them were New Zealand citizens, the magistrate couldn't help. But the newspaper published a follow-up article on the refusal, and several townspeople stepped forward to donate to the cause.
Within a day, they raised enough money to hire a crew. Mr. Cross volunteered the Flying Scud for the mission. Against the recommendation of the doctor, Captain Musgrave decided to sail with them too.
Alec and Raynal stayed behind. Since they'd landed in Invercargill, Reynald's dysentery had relapsed once again. He could hardly stand, let alone sail.
On the afternoon of July 29th, Musgrave and Reynald said their goodbyes. Reynald wrote, "I grasped my friend's hand, and penetrated by an emotion I could hardly restrain, I saw him set out again for the Auckland's, on board the Flying Scud, in the midst of the acclamations of an enthusiastic crowd."
For weeks, Reynald and Alec waited for Musgrave to return with the other men. After a month passed, Reynald feared the worst.
Finally, on September 15th, 1865, the Flying Scud reappeared in the harbor. As the news of her arrival spread through Invercargill, the entire town hurried to the docks to greet her. Reynald could only shout the same word again and again. Saved! Saved!
23 months after setting sail from Sydney, the crew of the Grafton was safely back on land. But their reunion was short-lived. Only a few days after returning from Auckland Island, the five men split up again.
George decided to stay in New Zealand and try his hand at prospecting. He'd been tempted by rumors of newly discovered gold fields.
Reynald, Alec, and Henry each took a place on a cargo ship headed to Melbourne, Australia. They all wanted to return to Sydney as soon as possible.
Captain Musgrave had reunited with an old friend in Invercargill and sailed back to Melbourne on his ship. Along the journey, he told the friend about his time on Auckland.
Musgrave revealed that when he went back to retrieve George and Henry, he'd spotted smoke from a fire on the other side of the island. When they went to investigate it, they realized that there had been another shipwrecked crew living on the island at the same time.
However, none of that crew had survived. Musgrave found only their bodies.
This discovery haunted Musgrave. As much as they suffered in their time on the island, at least they had all made it off alive. Captain Musgrave made it his mission to keep any other shipwrecked crews from perishing on Auckland Island.
A few weeks after returning to Australia, Musgrave petitioned the government for funds to check the island for any additional survivors. He set sail again on October 3rd, 1865, to thoroughly comb the island and make sure no one else was stranded there.
In addition, he placed a store of food and supplies inside Epigwhite for any potential future castaways to use.
He continued these efforts for the next several years, returning three more times to both search for survivors and place stocks of provisions in different depots on the island.
Because of his dedication, Musgrave's story and the wreck of the Grafton became very well known in Australia. He even published his captain's log into a book, Castaway on the Auckland Isles. It sold thousands of copies in both Australia and England.
The harrowing survival of his crew has been described as one of the most impressive examples of leadership and resolve.
It's interesting that Captain Musgrave is remembered as the hero of the Grafton and not Francois Reynald. It was only through Reynald's cleverness that they were able to build the rescue ship, the forge, the fireplace, all the practical things that saved them. But several scholars give more credit to Musgrave simply because he was the captain.
Reynald's final contribution to the saga of the Grafton came in the form of his own book, Wrecked on the Reef. It started as a series of articles published in a French newspaper. They were eventually compiled and published in five languages. It was wildly popular.
Christian Mortelier, a French scholar, argued that Reynald's book had a significant impact on author Jules Verne. She points out several links in Verne's various publications, most notably the novel The Mysterious Island. It follows a crew of five shipwrecked Americans on an uncharted island in the South Pacific.
According to Mortelier, this book haunted Jules Verne's imagination to the end of his career.
It's understandable why Verne and so many others would be captivated by the story of the Grafton. It's a story of incredible ingenuity in the name of survival that seems too impossible to be true.
The remains of Epic White are still standing on Auckland Island, the final record of their struggle. It has been named a cultural landmark by the New Zealand government and a World Heritage Site. Several artifacts are also housed in the National Museum of New Zealand, including Raynal's forged bellows.
In 1907, the Dundonald shipwrecked on Auckland Island. Because of the supply depots, the 15 crew members were able to survive for 7 months until they were rescued by another ship.
The New Zealand government continues to regularly stock the island with supplies, fulfilling Captain Musgrave's promise that anyone who wrecked on Auckland would have what they need to survive.
Thanks for listening to Survival. We'll be back next week with a new episode.
You can find all of Parcast's shows on Spotify and anywhere you listen to podcasts.
If you enjoy the show, the best way to help is to leave a 5-star review.
And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. We'll see you next time. Survival was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound design by Carrie Murphy, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro, Paul Mahler, and Maggie Admire. This episode of Survival was written by Abigail Cannon and stars Irma Blanco and Tim Johnson.